is CoDiscovery. Hello and welcome to this episode of CoDiscovery with me, Abigail Acton. Pollution, climate change, and biodiversity loss are all threatening our sustainable use of marine resources. At the same time, we need seafood. The United Nations reports the world's population is more than three times larger than it was in the mid-20th century, and food security is a growing concern. It's a conundrum. We need to harvest more food from the ocean while preserving stocks and ensuring biodiversity. One solution is fish farming. Farmed fish have one of the lowest carbon animal protein footprints, and fish are nutritious. But there are drawbacks. Another solution is to use technology to enhance the fishing process so that we fish more smartly. But today's episode is not just about how fish can feed us. It's also about what fish can teach us. Our three guests today, whose work has been supported by EU funding, will be able to tell us more. Welcome to Rachel Tiller, who is a Chief Scientist and Director of Biodiversity and Area Use, a strategic research program run by SINTEF Ocean, a research institute based in Trondheim, Norway. She's keen to find a way of putting tools in the hands of fishers to make their work more productive and environmentally friendly. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here.
And we're excited to have you. Margaret Ray is the Managing Director of Conry Innovation, based in Galway, Ireland. The company aims to harness the latest technological approaches to improve the health and welfare of farmed fish. Hello, Margaret.
Hi, Abigail. Hi, everyone.
Mark Muller, now retired, was a Senior Assistant Professor at the Belgian National Fund for Scientific Research, FNRS, working at the University of Liège. He studies gene regulation and developmental biology in various species, mostly focusing on skeleton formation in zebrafish. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
So, Rachel, the Smart Fish Project has put innovative tools in the hands of the fishing community to help them catch what they're intending to catch and register the content more simply. Can you tell us what issues your project was seeking to tackle?
Well, we were looking into how we could make the fishing sector more environmentally friendly. It has a bad rep for some, and we do want to emphasize that the fishers in general are not out there trying to break any rules. But there's a lot of misconceptions about it, but there's also a lot of uncertainties around how they can change their fishing behavior in order to be more environmentally friendly in a sense. And we also need more food from the ocean. So we're not going to stop fishing, but we need to do it in a way that we don't throw away fish we don't want. We make sure that we don't harvest too small species or that we don't take any red listed fish, so fish that are on the brink of extinction. And in order to do that, we need to come up with some technologies that would enable the fishers to perhaps see underwater before they pulled up a catch, or be able to record automatically what they caught so that we would have that information as managers or as researchers or even as just a regular person wanting to buy some fish to have the knowledge about what fish they're eating.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And I would imagine also that fishers would be really glad to have these tools at their fingertips. As you say that yourself, I mean, you know, they're not out there to game the system in any way. And I'm sure they're, you know, horrified at the amount of bycatch they catch accidentally as well. So I can imagine that this is something that's very welcome. You're quite right. Fish are needed to provide a secure source of food, but environmental degradation is a problem. So what is your project actually doing to address the challenges that you've just mentioned? Can you give me some examples?
Well, we were looking at, if you look in the water then, for example, because we were looking both in the water and on deck. So in the water, some of the technologies we were developing were, for example, a system where we could have a camera inside the trawl so that the fisher would be able to see like really good quality while he's actually on the boat, whether or not, you know, how big they were. Are they just like juvenile fish there, so baby fish, or are these like the exact the size fish he wants? And if he sees that, okay, this is a good composition, he can actually close that trawl and start pulling it in. But if he sees that these are just small ones, he'll just keep it open so that they can keep swimming through it.
I've got a question that comes to, I've got a question that comes to mind. I mean, I'm seeing like, you know, thousands of frantically moving fish, very agitated in an increasingly small environment. How does your camera actually manage to capture the necessary images to inform the fishermen? Is it that at the beginning there are fewer fish and they can see that the trend is going to be negative and that they should let them just go? you know, how does that make sense of that turmoil?
Well, it's some of these have really, really good quality. So we have developed one that's called a trawl monitor, and that's it's a really high quality camera that I can actually see in really turbulent waters as well. And also remember, the fishers are experts in this. They do know what fish they want, and they can see that. So we're giving them the power to make those decisions. It's beneficial for them as well. If they have a catch with two small fish, they will get a lower price for that fish. So they do want that perfect composition. But you do there's been a lot of development in camera technologies just over the last 5 or 6 years.
Right.
You can see that.
Super. Can you give me some other examples? Like I know, for example, you've got a fascinating idea of actually how to deter unwanted species from coming into the net. Tell me about that one, Rachel.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, we've been doing a lot of experiments with lights. So it's one of the technologies is called the light lines. It basically illuminates the fishing gear. So you can sew it into the nets or you can have it hanging on it. And what it does is that you can trigger these from the vessel. So again, it gives the power to the fisher. And he might be able to see that, oh, okay, we're getting a mixed catch here of two species. And we really want one of them. But we want to get rid of the other one because it could be red listed or it could be too small, too big. It could be something you don't have a quota for. And in that case, they can trigger these lights. And there are some specific wavelengths that of light, basically, that's green or it's red or yellow, whichever. When they activate that, it can encourage some fish to either say like, hey, let's move towards that light or let's move away from that light. So when you combine that with the technologies of opening parts of the trawl, it might get like some of these species to go further down where there's an escape route, and the others might want to just keep on moving upwards where they're basically trapped. So it's a good way of selecting. And it's still under development. We're not done testing this, but we see some really promising results.
I think it's absolutely fascinating. I really do. And you are actually seeing some species are attracted, for example, to a red light and some are deterred.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that interesting? I mean, of course, it begs the question, what's the motivation and, you know, what's the mechanism in the fish that causes some species to be attracted to a green light and others to want to run away from it or swim away, rather, no legs.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give me an example of some other innovations that you're coming up with? Because I just love all this. I think this is brilliant.
Yeah, so now we're still in the water, but if we think about what happens once you get the fish on board, one of the innovations we're working on is with artificial intelligence and cameras again. And it's about being able to basically count every fish as it comes on board. And the reason why this is important is because we don't know what's in the ocean right now. We don't know how many species, we don't know what kind of species, we don't know how much we're catching. And we don't know how the fish are changing behavior because of climate change. So are we suddenly seeing new species in an area? With this automatic catch registration, one, it takes away so much work for the fishers. They don't have to sit and manually guesstimate how much fish is coming aboard. They're really good, but they only have about a 10% variation they're allowed to have. But with this automatic catch registration and using artificial intelligence, basically develop these digital twins of all the fish so that when it sees the fish, it'd be like, oh, I've seen a million images of this cod. I know that's a cod, even if it doesn't have a head or it's lacking half its tail.
Right.
So, and then we can basically send that information just automatically lock that information and send it off. And the fishers don't have to worry about it. If something is wrong, that's the program's fault and not theirs. So they can't be punished for it.
That's absolutely brilliant. They must be really, I mean, the idea of having to do that manually, gosh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You would think they're happy. They are not happy.
Isn't that interesting? I would be like, oh my God, I don't have to count my pollock ever again. Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a little bit of pushback.
Oh, a lot of pushback. You got to think of this, though. This is for a lot of them, especially this part on board the vessel. It could feel like a big brother kind of feeling. Like, why do you don't trust me?
Right. Okay.
Why do you think I'm not reporting the correct numbers?
Right. And it's not that at all. It's not that at all. You're just putting tools at their fingertips that's going to save time and make the whole system more accurate. Yeah.
More accurate, more effective. But it's also like they're fearing, is this going to cost a lot?
Yeah.
These are very real fears. I mean, putting artificial intelligence, a camera vision, and new equipment on board a vessel.
Yeah. No, I get it. It's funny. I mean, we're so tuned into the whole notion of AI as being a subplot for something, some sort of horror story. But in fact, of course, it's a very useful tool for us, really. Rachel, this is fascinating.
Yeah, and I would just want to say that, just about that, because it's like everyone is so excited about AI, and you can use ChatGPT. And finally, for me at least, I'm like, okay, we're using AI for something practical. We're using it for something that can save the environment, not just write a resume or a travel itinerary.
Yeah, absolutely, not frivolous. Because quite often when you read this kind of tech news, you think, okay, very nice, but kind of frivolous. Mm-hmm. But this not. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Rachel, what got you into all of this in the first place? Why are you doing this?
Well, I am a researcher and I do love the ocean. I work in SINTEF Ocean. Our job is to come up with technology for a better society. But I'm also in the fisheries technology group, and I chose to be in fisheries technology because I do love fisheries. I'm from a fishing family. My entire family going generations back have been fishers. I want to be able to work closely with them to come up with solutions. I want to be able to change the misconception of fishers just being the big villains of the ocean. I mean, they're doing humanity, I would say, a great favor, because we do need more food from the ocean. But we also need to be able to just give someone proof that they're not the bad people out there. In general, you know, 99% of them are doing just fine. And it really is it's unfortunate that you do have some that are cheating the system, that are making them all look bad. And I want to be part of that solution, coming up with tools for them to be able to demonstrate that they are following the rules. They are contributing to a better society. They are contributing to healthy food at a good price that is climate friendly compared to a lot of other food sources.
Rachel, thank you very much. You're quite right. Fish is a food source that we're going to need more of as the population grows. So Margaret, you're involved with fish farming, so it seems logical to turn to you next.
The Game Changer Project is using innovative technology to reduce the outbreaks of sea lice, a virulent pest that's holding back the aquaculture industry. So Margaret, please tell us about sea lice. What are they and what kind of damage can they do?
Hi Abigail, thanks a billion for having me on. Okay, so sea lice are tiny little crustaceans that parasitize salmon or indeed actual trout as well at sea. And of course, these are natural pests. They're naturally found in the environment. But in aquaculture, simply because you have coral fish in one location, they tend to get out of proportion to the situation itself. And so what they do is they cause little wounds on the fish. Those wounds themselves can get secondary bacterial or viral infections, which then also lead the fish to feel stressed. And stress fish is not a good thing. And salmon producers are looking for ways in which to control those sea lice in the water for the betterment of fish welfare, basically, and health. A happier, healthier fish for them is a much better product at the end of the day.
Yeah, indeed. We all want happy, healthy fish. Absolutely. I know that they are also, it's a challenge biologically, but there's also a lice limitation level set by regulatory authorities. What is a lice limit? I mean, obviously it means a limit to the amount of lice, but
yes.
Is that stringent? Is it difficult to adhere to?
Yes, it is quite stringent. Basically, it's there to protect, obviously the health and welfare of aquacultured fish, but also wild salmon. And so the regulatory agencies in everywhere salmon is produced at sea, basically there are regulatory limits set. And those limits are in Ireland and in Norway and Scotland. In most places around the world, it's 0.5 female sea lice per fish, basically, for most of the year. And then during the springtime, the time at which wild salmon are going in and out of rivers and estuaries, it's set much lower at around 0.2 female sea lice per fish, basically. So it's quite stringent, particularly in the springtime.
Yeah, right. And I imagine that must be a massive headache for fish farmers. So how are lice controlled at the moment?
So there's a lot of different ways at the moment in which lice are controlled. And what they tend to do is they tend to rotate those treatments so that we're not developing what's called a super lice, because that's what happened in the past. Mm. They overcame, let's say, different types of medicines that were used for them, and it bred a super lice.
Okay. They became resistant, huh?
They became resistant, yeah. So they don't really want that to happen again. And so they tend to use different types of treatments. So they tend to use more mechanical treatments at the moment, where they pump up the fish from the salmon pen, and they bring it onto what's called a well boat. And they, on the well boat, they treat them in different ways, and then they put them back into the salmon pen again.
Which sounds quite stressful for the fish.
Absolutely, yeah. It's quite effective in terms of the sea lice. However, it's a temporary effect, normally within anything from 6 to 8 to maybe 12 weeks, it will reoccur again. And then there are medicated treatments. There are feeds that are out there that boost the immune systems. Of course, there are antibiotics, but antibiotics are normally used only for infections and bacterial or viral infections, and actually are practically not used at all anymore. So there's just a lot of different kinds of treatments out there that they tend to use in a rotational basis.
Right. They all sound a little bit like they're sort of temporary cures for a situation that,
yes,
that is being considered as inevitable. So it's like, it's sort of almost like, you know, trying to hold back a tide a little bit here. I think it sounds hard work. It also sounds quite expensive in terms of personnel. There's quite a lot of work that you've been describing there.
Yes, that's right. Well, first of all, you have to book or reserve a well boat, and that needs to come, you know, it needs to go from wherever its base is or wherever it was last booked, basically. So that needs to transit to you. So there's a time delay there before it can get to you. They're quite expensive. Depending on where they've come from and in what jurisdiction they are, it can be anything in and around 15,000 euros a day.
Okay.
But that really depends, you know, in different jurisdictions and things.
Yeah.
And you also have to pay for the transit cost.
Right. And then there's the fuel also, of it getting to and fro.
And fuel.
Yeah.
Exactly. And the manning, you know, the people who are on board, the skilled individuals that are on board.
Mm. And all for 8 weeks respite at best case scenario. Sounds quite intense. Yeah. Okay. Well, we can clearly see what the issue is. So now tell me a little bit about what you've been doing under the project.
Well, the Game Changer project was funded by the Women Tech EU. So that was fantastic. And the Women Tech EU was all about the deep tech companies. And so we have a science-led approach to the way we want to reliably manage and control sea lice. So you will never get rid of sea lice. They're natural pests in the normal natural environment. And so you will never, you know, completely eradicate, nor do you want to completely eradicate, because, of course, they're naturally found in the environment. So what we are doing is a science-led approach. I had the opportunity a couple of years ago to sit back and kind of really think about a science-led approach to this. So we've developed a hardware device that we will place in the water. It's non-chemical and it's non-polluting, and both things are highly appealing to the salmon farmers. We are patenting at the moment, so there's very, you know, it's kind of limited in what I can say, but really we will be in the salmon pen on a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week basis, and actively dealing with the problem in the salmon pen itself. And of course, the salmon pen is at sea, so it's a harsh environment. So there are a couple of things that we need to respect as well. So we need to respect the pen and not damage the salmon pen, and of course, not harm the fish as well. And effectively deal with the problem.
Yeah, sounds like a big ask. So basically, you've got a way of not using systems that remove the fish from their pens. They can stay where they are.
Yes.
So that's obviously better for the fish. Less time consuming and everything else that we've just discussed. You do mention machine learning and you do mention artificial intelligence. So I guess you've got a system which involves both of these things. Can you tell us just a little bit more about that?
Oh, sure. Yeah, with those kind of things, really, it's all about being able to find the sea lice, you know. And then, of course, count the sea lice too, because you obviously want to understand if there's a large loading of sea lice present, and you know, this can inform you about your kind of treatment side of things, and then it can also, though, inform your salmon producer as well. So at the end of the day, we also need to prove to our salmon producer that we're actually finding these and that we're actually treating them, and you know what I mean, and reducing their numbers. So having a camera system in the water that allows you to see sea lice and count them is a really important. And that's exactly what we're doing. So we're developing a camera system that will allow us to see the sea lice, count them. And of course, there's lots of different stages of sea lice. So it's the ability to see the different types of stages. And that can also help you determine really the loading that's actually in the water itself.
Okay, so that goes back to what you were saying about the parameters being females per fish. So, it's a life cycle thing, isn't it? And see when the population of sea lice is about to explode or not. Yeah, okay, excellent.
That's right. And of course, the females produce up to 1,000 eggs a month, so.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Therefore, it's all about the female.
Yeah, like it was about the mosquitoes in a previous episode. Uh-huh. Yeah, indeed. And it's interesting because Rachel also has been talking about cameras in nets and a way of using very, very high resolution images to determine what's actually going on under the water. So this is obviously a great ability to do this. So game changer by name, game changer by nature then, Margaret.
Hopefully so, fingers crossed.
Good.
We're in the starting stages of doing some field trials. We're waiting on those field trials, to show how effective we will be.
Okay, excellent. That sounds very good. Does anyone have any questions for Margaret? Yes, Rachel.
Actually, Margaret, I was just wondering, will your innovations have any other benefits for the environment in terms of how they will reduce the impact it has on the marine environment?
Oh, yeah. I think that there are a lot of different companies that are out there that are using AI for so many different things. Personally, I feel that you can use AI to look maybe from a microscopic level at things called harmful algal blooms, or indeed just monitoring the water until you get there. There are a lot of different companies out there that are doing that at the moment. And then, of course, measuring lots of other parameters, for instance, temperature, because temperature affects oxygen levels in the water. If there's less oxygen in the water, then it's not good either for the fish. And so being able to monitor the oxygen levels, salinity levels, and I suppose chlorophyll, just from a perspective of seeing harmful algal blooms. And harmful can be anything from just a lot of algae in the water, microalgae in the water, that overnight take oxygen from the water. So they respire overnight, taking oxygen from the water. And of course, overnight, they literally can suffocate the fish in that way. So some other companies are out there looking at those kind of things. And then, of course, another big one for salmon producers or any kind of fish producers at sea would be jellyfish. So equally, in the same way that you have microalgal blooms, you can also have jellyfish blooms, basically. And jellyfish can come in with their poisonous tentacles and things, and they can either begin to consume the smaller fish, or they can act and sting the gills, for instance. And then once again, the fish can't breathe properly and can suffocate. So I'm fairly sure that there are other companies out there that are looking at those particular issues. And of course, AI is fantastic for that.
Wonderful. It's always useful to hear about AI being good for some things, as well as, this sort of weird dystopian future we're managing to scare ourselves with as well. Yeah, this is excellent. Thank you very much. And I suppose all of these things are the idea of prevention being better than cure. So they avoid the use of perhaps chemical processes and so on by anticipating the problem rather than trying to deal with it.
Yes.
Mark, yes, you have an observation or a question, please.
Yes. I wanted to ask which phase of the life cycle of the salmon is actually affected by these sea lice. Is this also only in seawater when they are in the big cages, or is it also in the younger stages when they are in freshwater?
No, it's really for sea lice, it's really when they're put out to sea, what they call the on-growing stages. Indeed, in freshwater, there are other lice species in freshwater. They're, for instance, an argillus species. And you'll find that in, for instance, still water in lakes and things, and mostly affects trout. So some countries, for instance, for angling, they would tend to rear trout and that for angling. And so some freshwater species you can find of lice that will affect lots of different fish species in freshwater itself, but not to the extent, I think, for instance, at sea. There's a particularly difficult sea lice species is called Leptioptera salmonis, and this is the one that really causes a lot of stress to salmonids in at sea. Other species like argillus, sometimes the fish just tends to shrug it off. It's things to think, oh, it's not so bad.
Okay.
Thank you very, very much. That's excellent. Thanks, Margaret. I'm going to turn to you, Mark. Your project, Biomed Aqua, is at the interface of aquaculture and biomedicine. They're not fields that I've actually thought of as complementary before. So, Mark, can you tell us how the two domains relate to each other?
Yes, of course. The common part is actually the fact that fish are vertebrates, so fish have bones. And so fish have jaws, if fish have a face, fish have a vertebral column, just like people. So in that respect, they are quite the same. On the other hand, it's also becoming more and more clear that mechanisms and the processes going into bone development and bone formation are similar in fish and humans. Now, if you talk about skeletal pathologies or skeletal problems in humans, you talk about maybe craniofacial deformities that you see in kids, or mainly also osteoporosis, which leads to bone fractures, or osteoarthritis, which elderly people also feel pain in their joints. Now, these are problems in our aging populations, but these are also problems that you can find in aquaculture species. So in that respect, seeing that the mechanisms are the same, you can study the same thing in these different species.
Interesting. And I know that you particularly are looking at zebrafish. So you really are in the middle. You're looking at zebrafish and you're giving information back to on the medical side of things, but also to the aquaculture side of things. Tell me a little bit about why zebrafish is so central to this.
Yes, indeed. So actually for biomedical researchers working with patients, they obviously also need a model, an animal model, to study things that you cannot study in patients. And the zebrafish is increasingly used for that because it as I said, mechanisms are common. The genome is quite similar. And so what you can do is actually generate models for each of these different pathologies that I was talking about in zebrafish. And then you can study this in the zebrafish because it is a fast-developing fish, actually. So you can look at the larvae and use the larvae to study them. And the larvae are transparent, which is also a very big advantage.
Right. Excellent. So it's like a window into these vital processes of development that are going wrong.
Right.
And that's of interest also to the aquaculture industry because...
And then we are coming to the aquaculture researchers who are actually working with much larger fish. These aquaculture fish are much larger, of course, because we want to eat them. and they also grow older. And an important difference is also that you have a huge amount of larvae when a single female can lay thousands of eggs. And so you have a huge population where you can do very nice feeding experiments, for example, or environmental studies of temperature or sea lice, for example, effect on the population and on the skeleton. So that's how we came to define this project, where we really thought that we would bring together biomedical people studying human patients, zebrafish, and people studying bigger fish, aquaculture fish, and to see how they can interact, how they can help each other. And that was the whole idea, actually.
I think it's a fantastic concept. I really do. So tell me some of your findings. What did you actually discover?
Yeah, well, the project was actually an international training network. So we had 15 PhD students working on different aspects. So it was very broadly, actually, in terms of subjects that we were studying.
I was interested in what you said about the generation of mutant cell lines for the genes looking at the reasons for early onset osteoporosis or osteoarthritis. So I understand that you were curious about the homeostasis. Can you explain a little bit what homeostasis means and why this was of interest for you?
Okay, when I talk about homeostasis, it's a term that maybe not everybody knows. Homeostasis is actually how to maintain the actual state of affairs. So in terms of bone skeleton, this means actually bone is continuously reconfigured and remodeled during the entire life. So bones are all the time destroyed and rebuilt. And so you actually have to have an equilibrium there to keep a healthy skeleton still working. And so that's what I mean by homeostasis. So during aging, during the life cycle, to keep a functioning skeleton. This is opposed to development, which means that from the egg at the beginning, you have to build a skeleton, first of all, and then you have to keep it healthy. So these are the two aspects that can be covered.
Okay. And you were talking about the vertebral column being involved in some of the most prominent skeletal deformities. I think you were looking at dietary phosphate levels, for example.
Oh, yes, you are heading right to this, to the project there. Yes, of course. So bone is actually made of calcium phosphate. So phosphate means phosphorus. And so several of the PhD students actually were studying the effect of phosphorus in the diet. You have to bring the phosphorus to the diet of fish because they cannot get it from the environment. And so what we found out is actually that playing around with the concentration or the amount of phosphorus in the feed, you can influence the structure, the internal structure of the bone. You can have very solid bone, very strong bone, or much weaker bone, depending on the phosphorus, on the amount of phosphorus that you put in the diet. And in the end, we saw that in zebrafish, we saw that in salmon, and probably also in humans. So that's how we will now go on to see. Eventually, we can use that to treat some of the human conditions as well.
Oh, excellent. And in fact, that leads me on to my next question to you. Thank you. Now the project is over. I mean, what is going to be the work that's going to be done on the shoulders of the project going forward? So what's the next step?
Actually, the first thing will be to follow up with these phosphorus studies, of course. We also, as I said before, some of the genes that we identified that are important, that we showed are important in zebrafish, we can now integrate them in genetic testing for human patients if they have osteoporosis or some effect. A lot of our results also concern feed, so the diet. And so we have been studying the effect of vitamin D, of selenium, of probiotics on skeletal health. And all this can eventually be transferred to human patients in a similar situation.
So basically what we're doing now, which is wonderful, is you're taking what you've discovered and now it's kind of like a more practical phase where you can start implementing some of the things that you've discovered and maybe taking those into new levels of testing.
Indeed. We want to go a little bit further into the testing on humans. And we also have some substances that we identified to be beneficial to bone health. And this can also now go into more clinical trials if you want.
Excellent. Well, that sounds wonderful. That's really super. I think that's a lovely example of some strange, well, to me, strange anyway, symbiosis that's come together really well. Thank you so much. Yes, Margaret.
Yes, it's fascinating, Mark. Well, really, really fascinating. I'm, you know, just thinking that in much the same way, you know, that you're inspecting the zebrafish larvae, I'm just wondering, can you also look at salmon eggs and do kind of a, you know, rapid inspection and detection of abnormalities and so, you know, weed out the ones that are not going to do so well?
I don't see a problem in principle. I don't know if the eggs are transparent. Salmon eggs are transparent.
Up to a certain level, you know, if you shine light through them, you can see.
Hold them against the light.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah. So, yeah.
Well, you could have some sort of luminosity screening going on there. I mean, if you knew what you were looking for within the eggs and then you found a way to actually...
Yeah. Zebrafish eggs are completely transparent. So, so you can really see under the microscope. Which might not be the case for salmon. I have never seen salmon eggs.
Okay.
I think I have in sushi, actually.
I have to say, but I don't think they are so transparent. But obviously, yes, you can do quite a lot of things. You can also do a lot of live staining that you could do eventually, and then fluorescent staining and do fluorescent microscopy.
What do you mean by live staining, Mark?
Live staining, there are certain substances like calcein, for example, that can stain the bone directly. It goes directly into the animal and stains the bone, for example, and the bone becomes green fluorescent. So you can see it under a fluorescent microscope. So that could be an option as well. Yeah.
To make things apparent.
Yeah.
Because I guess it must be quite expensive for the aquaculture industry to have fish that then become deformed as they grow. It must be quite useful to be able to weed out the ones.
Yes, definitely. Yes. I think they screen them at several stages. So some are screened at larval stages. And so there's a big loss there anyway, and especially also due to vertebral deformities. But some of them actually happen later on, and that's much more difficult there and much more costly because you have to feed them until
exactly.
That stage
You've
and
done.
Then throw them away.
So, yeah. And you've done all that lice prevention work as well, for maybe no reason.
Obviously, yes.
Sounds like you two might have something to talk about there. That sounds like that would be probably quite a nice little bit of avenue of exploration.
Could well be.
To try and save the money and also save the fish. Okay. Thank you very much. Well, that's absolutely fascinating. I've really enjoyed this. I think that I've learned a lot with regards to how AI is really reshaping both aquaculture and wild fishing. And I think it's really interesting, Mark, what you've been saying about what we can learn just from zebrafish, which don't necessarily immediately leap out at us as being something very similar to ourselves. So I want to thank you very much for being with me today and for sharing your ideas. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us. Very interesting.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Super. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts or whatever streaming service you use, and check out the podcast homepage on the Cordis website. Subscribe to make sure that the hottest research in EU-funded science isn't passing you by. We've talked about cutting-edge sensors that can detect whether a flying mosquito is carrying Zika virus and how resources on the moon could help us explore space. In our last 32 episodes, there will be something there to tweak your curiosity. Perhaps you want to know what other EU funding projects are doing to make the use of aquatic resources more sustainable. The Cordis website will give you an insight into the results of projects funded by Horizon 2020 and Horizon Europe that are working in the area. The website has articles and interviews that explore the results of research being conducted in a very broad range of domains and subjects, from qubits to qubits. See what I did there? There is something in there for you. Maybe you're involved in a project or would like to apply for funding. Take a look at what others are doing in your domain. So come and check out the research that's revealing what makes our world tick. We're always happy to hear from you. Drop us a line, editorial@cordis.europa.eu. Until next time.